During the war, they were. Did they have just one plant in England and one plant in Canada?
Well, because of the nature of the way it was made, they could build all sorts of little parts and all these little factories around the UK, and then they tended to come together at Hatfield, where the aeroplanes were put together in the production. But they made lots of bits and pieces in all these little woodwork factories around the country. In Canada, they made it all, basically, I think, at Downsview in the de Havilland factory there, and then they built them again in Australia. They didn't make that many in Australia, but they did build them in Australia as well.
Well, I understand, if Wikipedia is right, that some of the Canadian plywood came from here in Wisconsin. Had you heard that before?
Yes, I had heard that. The Canadian production sort of lagged a little bit behind the UK production. Interestingly enough, I guess, the plywood that was procured, we bought for this aeroplane, came from a company called British Plywood, not surprisingly. But British Plywood made the original plywood during World War II with timber from North America. They were still in business in 2005 when this project came about. And we ordered the plywood from the same manufacturer that made the plywood during World War II. And it must have been, I don't know why, but it was like they were waiting for that order because they made that load of plywood and then they closed down. It's built, the plywood's made by the same people that made it originally. And I say that the trees came from the same forest, but other people disagree.
But the plywood itself, of course, it's not like you just go to the Home Depot and go buy plywood. Where did you get the specifications of how the plywood was to be built?
Yes, well, I guess multiply, people that are familiar with plywood nowadays, most plywood nowadays is multiply. In other words, if you had a quarter-inch piece of plywood, it may have 7 or 9 plies, veneers to make it. But the Mosquito is built entirely out of 3-ply. So even though some of the plywood on the wing skins is a quarter-inch thick, it's still only 3-ply. So the whole engineering design has been based around the fact that the plywood is twice as strong in one direction as it is in the other, because it's 2 skins going one way and 1 veneer going the other. So it's a sort of unique design, and you can't change the plywood style without re-engineering the fact that it's no longer 3-ply. So the specification was a typical British specification of the time, and you can get all the specifications, fortunately, yeah, for everything.
Of course, it was a long restoration, as most well restorations are. What would you say would be the most difficult problem you had to overcome when you did this?
Well, I guess with most of the aeroplanes that you see flying these days, there's an industry built up around the restoration of them. So, if you're thinking about a Mustang or a Spitfire or something like that, the people have been restoring them for the last 30 years, and all these little sort of pathways to finding bits and pieces have already been established. But when you're starting with an aeroplane that basically given up for dead, you have to develop all those pathways, and you have to find all the people that have got the parts, and you have to find all the drawings, and you have to work out how you're going to make things that have been out of production for 70 years. So I suppose the fact that we were the first people to be doing it meant that we had to kind of solve all those problems ourselves. Couldn't ring the Mosquito guy and ask him what to do. So you had to become those people yourself, and that is probably the biggest challenge. It's all very well having the drawings, and you might have 10,000 of them, but some of them you can't read because they're so badly deteriorated. If you can read it, it's probably not the one you want. So there are gaps in the technical publications that make things a bit of a challenge. And then you also have resistance from companies like British Aerospace, who didn't want to provide the drawings to a private company to build a Mosquito again because they saw some liability issues associated with that. So they hung on to their drawings, which made it even more difficult than it ordinarily should have been. But that side of it, getting all the technical information together and finding the missing parts. I mean, the project was quite complete, oddly enough, even though it looked awful. The woodwork had rotted away, but the metalwork that was left had sort of survived quite well, I think, because the wood tended to soak up the water. But then, there were obviously missing parts, and because people had never really thought of Mosquitoes as having a commercial future, they didn't tend to hang on to the bits. They'd be walking through a scrapyard, pushing Mosquito pieces out of the way to get to a piece of Spitfire. And so Mosquito stuff tended to get lost, and the ones that have been saved are in museums and hard to get hold of.
You have quite a restoration facilities all over New Zealand, isn't that correct?
Yeah, well, we don't have enough money to buy anything new, so we have to overhaul everything we've got. So that tends to be, yeah, we do have a lot of restoration goes on in New Zealand, and our company's been involved in a number of great restorations, for not just for Jerry here, but for other people that you may have seen bring the aeroplanes to Oshkosh. So, yes, we've got some very talented people working for us, and obviously that makes all the difference. You need craftsmen to build these aeroplanes, and we're very lucky in New Zealand that we have a sort of good stash of craftsmen out there that we can talk into working on aeroplanes. But you have to have a client as well, of course.
Dave, now you've flown and you were the test pilot on the airplane. Tell us a little bit about the flight characteristics, particularly versus another airplane or other airplanes that you've flown, other fighters, and also single engine performance, etc.
In fact, I shared the test flying with another chap, Keith Skilling, who's got a great background in warbird flying. But like most Havilland airplanes, it flies very nicely, up to about 210, 210, 220 miles an hour. The controls are light and responsive and nicely harmonised. When you get above that, because of the lack of, it doesn't have powered flight controls, it starts to become quite heavy. And by the time you get 250, 280, 300, ailerons in particular are fairly heavy. But New Havilland went to a lot of trouble to make it nice to fly. It's kind of servoed. The elevator, rudder, and ailerons all have a kind of a manual servo assistance via some very clever mechanisms that they thought of. So for its era, I think its handling was really exceptional. But like I think most of these airplanes, once you get above about 250 or so, they become quite heavy. A single engine flight, once the airplane's in the cruise and clean, no problem at all. Where it grows horns is at low speed with an engine failure. It's often said that the rudder and fin are really too small for the asymmetry and thrust produced by the engines. Typical liftoff speed is around 120 miles an hour. If you lose an engine, you can't retain control of the airplane until you get to 190 miles an hour. So there's kind of a 70 mile an hour graveyard gap there, which a lot is made of, but engine failures on takeoff didn't happen that often. I mean, the airplane's just been run up, it hasn't been shot at yet, so most probably it's going to keep going through that gap. I think more threatening was the single engine landing, where you've got an awful lot of drag out with the flaps and gear down, one engine. If you start going a little bit low on approach, there's a great temptation to push the power up. Well, because you're back at 120 or thereabouts to land, you don't have the rudder authority to counter that. And I spoke to a lot of guys via email or directly regarding the handling characteristics, and one gentleman flew them in the RAF the latter stage of the war and early post-war. He's saying that they're obliged by their squadron rules to do at least one engine operative landing per month because it was so dangerous or demanded so much skill to stay in practice. Well, of course, they lost more aeroplanes practicing this than they did from the real failures. And the big threat was that there was just so much drag on the aeroplane with gear and flaps down and such a small rudder. If you start pushing the power up, the aeroplane's just going to roll over and crash. Typically on approach with two engines, you're looking at maybe 24 inches of manifold pressure. It's quite a high power setting. That's with two engines. So now if you lose one and you've got one prop windmilling and you start pushing up the power on the live, you're going to lose control very quickly. Now, this gentleman I was talking to, he actually witnessed three of his colleagues kill themselves in that way.
Now, what's your normal speed of the way your configuration you're flying now would be over the fence?
The runway you operate out of mostly was not overly long, so we'd be crossing the fence about 120. You'd actually like to cross a little faster than that, I think, because they just so you'd have a bit of margin if one engine did let go.
But you say VMCA was 190?
That's right. Once the gear and flaps come down, there's a huge drag increase, and my understanding of the airplane is with gear and flaps down on one engine, even with one propeller feathered, you cannot maintain height. You're going down. So once the gear's down, you're landing.
It's a controlled descent, is that correct?
That's right. Well, hopefully controlled.
Well, all in all, though, they didn't lose a disproportionate amount in the Second World War, did they? I mean, considering for the Lancaster or any of the other bombers, I mean, it was actually did fairly well.
It did a fantastic job, and no one really cared about those sorts of accidents. So pilots of the day were much happier having the extra performance that you get as a result of having a small rudder and fin and so on. I mean, they weren't built for single-engine safety. They're built for performance and to do the job. And so pilots loved them because, I guess, comparatively speaking, with the other types around, it was easier to stay alive in one of these than most other aircraft because you could escape from the bad guys.
Now, of all the roles it did, recon and light bomber and attack bomber, what would you say was its best role in the Second World War?
I think it did them all really well. I think it's often said it was the best photo reconnaissance aircraft of World War II. Full stop, but it did the night intruder thing, night fighter thing very, very well. There's really nothing it was bad at, I think. Other maybe kind of 1v1 combat with a single-engine fighter, then you would be at a disadvantage if he could catch you.
Well, I understand that Hermann Göring even wrote a letter that he was very frustrated that the Germans couldn't do anything any better than a wooden bomber, and he really wrote a nasty letter to the rest of the Luftwaffe. Did you ever read anything about that?
Yeah, I think Hermann had quite a lot to say about the Mosquito. Quite early on in the war, he was giving a speech in Berlin. I think that was at a time when the Allies still hadn't bombed Berlin, and so they timed the Mosquito raid to be dropping some bombs just outside the studio where he was making a speech, right when he started talking. And they had to sort of shut down the speech and take cover for a little while until the airplanes had gone. So, yeah, it's very aptly named Mosquito, I think. It caused Hermann a lot of grief.
Warren, can you give us any more pearls of wisdom here about the airplane?
Well, just on that subject of how effective it was, they used to be able to do two raids to Berlin in a night in a Mosquito. So you would take off just on dark, go to Berlin, drop some bombs, come back home again, have a snack while they loaded it up, and go back again and do it twice in one night. So that sort of gives you an idea of how effective it was. It was also, I think, I can't exactly remember the numbers, but there was an aeroplane lost for every 40 tons of bombs with the heavy aeroplanes, but it was 200 tons of bombs for the Mosquito. So they were in an order of five times more effective as far as fatalities were concerned compared to the heavy bombers. So, yeah, they were very, very effective. They even fitted a field gun to the Mosquito. They made a Mosquito Mark 18, I think it was called, and it had a single 5-pound 57mm gun mounted where these 420mm cannons are, and it was particularly effective at anti-shipping because of its incredible accuracy. It didn't have a high rate of fire, but a huge shell. So, you know, they could fill the aeroplane with pretty much anything that you could think of. A 4,000-pound bomb, which looked like an enormous 52-gallon drum, only five times the size, and they had to make a big bulbous bomb bay to fit this enormous 4,000-pound bomb in it. Obviously filled it full of cameras. They also used it to shuttle dignitaries and government officials around. They had a sort of an arrangement where you could sit in the belly and get flown to Sweden or Switzerland or wherever it was, and you would just rely on the fact that it could go higher and faster than everybody else, and you were safe that way. So they were, there was pretty much nothing that it didn't do. It was used for all sorts of things, and known to be able to take a lot of flak damage and bullet damage without losing the ability to control it. And it was known as the airplane that would get you back home again.